Fisher. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm here with everybody again. This will not be a solo podcast, so those of you who are fans of solo podcasts, rejoice. We're here with Sky Gittani. Hi, Sky.
Hey, Phil.
And Christian Taylor. Hey,
Christian. There, Phil.
Did you beep?
That was my watch.
Top of the hour. Sorry.
Oh, that was your watch saying time for the podcast.
Right.
Time for the podcast. We're all back together. Everyone's been all over the place, but we're all back together now. So it's time to sing the theme song. With ukulele, not optional. Hey, it's a podcast. What do you know? Hey, it's a podcast. So there's no video. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Fisher podcast starts right here. We'll talk to Sky and Christian too, and maybe a guest, but we don't have one today for you. Hey, it's a podcast. So lend an ear. The Phil Fisher podcast starts right here. The Phil Fisher podcast starts right here. Okay. Everyone's back. We're here. I was first topic. Last week was the Christian Booksellers Association annual convention, which used to be called CBA, but that's the name of the organization, so they changed the name of the convention to ICRS. Do you guys know what that stands for?
International Christian Retailers Show.
Hey, very good. Except it's retail, not retailers, but that's okay.
Okay.
You were really close. You got 9 out of 10. It was the biggest. It used to be called the CBA show, and it's a trade show, fairly large. In the mid 90s to late 90s, it was quite large, and that was kind of the peak of VeggieTales. And it's kind of shrinking. You can also call it the Incredible Shrinking Trade Show, which is true of a lot of trade shows. A lot of the trade show business in general has been shrinking since a lot of things have gone online, and especially when you sell things. For example, there used to be, 2,000 independent Christian retailers, and so they all would go to trade shows to buy things, to place orders, and that has shrunk significantly, and now there's, maybe 400 independent Christian retailers because the chains have kind of taken over. And when you have chains in any market, they tend not to buy at trade shows. You go to them and sell to them. Walmart does not come to a trade show to order things. People go to Walmart to buy. And so that's happened in the Christian market. But there's a bigger trend that I think is more interesting, in that we had a generation with VeggieTales of parents that, especially moms, that were in the habit of going to Christian bookstores to look for stuff. Stuff that they heard about on the radio from James Dobson or somebody like that. And then they would go to a Christian bookstore, and there were Christian bookstores everywhere, and they would go and find the stuff and give it to their kids. And we seem to have a new generation that doesn't do that anymore, that they find enough on TV that they're comfortable with, or they'll find things online that they're comfortable with, and the younger generation doesn't, of parents, the new generation of parents doesn't seem to go to Christian bookstores. Have you noticed that, Sky?
Yeah.
In your travails?
I am a younger Christian parent.
And you go to...
Is 36 still young? Borderline.
Yes.
You go to Christian bookstores once a month?
Never.
You have young kids.
Never.
Man.
But
never.
What? I was one of those older Christian moms, because my oldest
is
20.
You were an old, young Christian mom.
Yes. So I was 20. Yes. My oldest is 22. My youngest is 10. And I don't remember the last time. I stopped going to the grocery store for a long time and had Peapod deliver my groceries.
Yeah.
So I wasn't even going to the grocery store. But
so you're waiting for the Peapod of Christian retail?
Well, I do think that the internet has changed things. And
yeah.
I've heard, anytime I hear anything that I'm interested in, I don't think about going to the store because I don't need one more place to go. I just order it.
Right,
online.
Right.
And I think that's a huge difference.
But you don't go to Christian retail online sites either. I mean, there are, I don't want to name them,
I go to
them free publicity, but there are Christian sites you can
right.
buy stuff from, but you typically don't go there either.
Mm-mm.
You go to Amazon.
Right.
Or sometimes I go to Christian book distributors.
CBD.
CBD.
Yeah, christianbook.com,
mm-hmm.
where you can find all of my stuff, and maybe some of it's on sale. I don't even know. But what does that mean? Because what's tricky is Christian retail was how we used to launch things.
Mm-hmm.
VeggieTales succeeded solely because of Christian retail, and that no longer exists. How does anyone launch anything?
Well, I think there's a question behind that question, which is there was some research
Should
done.
Should we launch things?
Well, hold on. I did some research for my first book about this question, and one of the things that came out of some surveys done by people like Gallup and Barna and others, when they looked at Christian behavior in the culture, they could really distinguish nothing different from non-Christians, except that Christians are more likely to buy Christian-branded merchandise. So the conclusion is essentially, if you want to know what it means to be a Christian in North America, at least statistically, it means you buy Jesus junk, God gadgets, Christian stuff. So for a long time, for a whole generation of Christians, the way you express your Christianity is you go to a Christian bookstore and you buy Christian stuff. And I think that
what would Jesus do? Bracelets.
Right. And I think that that way of expressing Christian faith is to a degree declining.
Right.
We're not as branded. So the whole draw of a Christian store where I can accessorize my Christian life isn't as
So how do you accessorize your Christian life today?
Well, hopefully you do it with good works and acts of love.
Where do you hear about interesting new books from Christian authors? Where do you hear about...
It's blogs. It's online. It's podcasts like this.
Yeah, and then you just order it on Amazon?
Right.
Is that the future?
Yeah, and Christian radio to a degree, but even that's declining pretty rapidly.
Except K-Love.
Well, it's music-based. Most Christian radio used to be the place you went to hear the preachers that you couldn't hear anywhere else.
Right.
Well, now you can get onto iTunes and listen to 100 different podcasts a day.
Podcasts, yeah. And it's very tricky in the kids' world because I still have probably almost once a week I get an email from someone who wants advice on launching their own Christian children's something, book, record, a touring show, you name it, something. And I don't have anything encouraging to say to them. You know, I mean, my response typically is, I don't know. I don't know how you can launch that. Well, no one is really looking for it. No, and they also want to know how to fund it. You know, can you connect me to someone who wants to fund a Christian kids video? No, I can't because I don't know anyone that wants to.
Well, I mean, we have our own Christian video series and we're trying to get the word out about that. And it's not easy or fast.
No,
I think the, you know...
What's the name of our Christian series?
It's called What's in the Bible, and we have some new stuff coming out. DVD number 8.
Is out now.
You know, and I got to tell you, the first time I sat down and watched it, which wasn't that long ago, I was really blown away. And I think, you know, and I had said if I'd ever, you know, as soon as I watched this, I wanted to see all of them, because I, as an adult, learned stuff about, you know, the Bible by watching that. But getting the word out about that has been very difficult. And so I think a lot of people just don't even know about it.
Well, so overall, do you think the decline of the Christian subculture is a positive thing or a negative thing? In what ways is it good? In what ways is it bad?
Well, in one way that it's good is what I mentioned earlier. People come to hopefully see that faith is more than just a branded expression. It isn't just the t-shirts you wear, the bracelets you wear, the stuff you buy. Hopefully it's something more than that. The downside is, and this is true for really throughout our culture, it's becoming harder and harder to aggregate like-minded people to accomplish things together. So it used to be you had a couple of television networks, a couple of radio stations, and they were the broadcasts that could rally like-minded people to a product or an idea or an event or a cause. And now our media is so fractured that you can't aggregate a sizable kind of critical mass of people anymore, which means it gets very hard to aggregate Christians together to put them in an audience to help them get a message and engage a culture. So that's a very, very challenging reality in our world.
Right. And we have in Illinois every year for the past 25 years or so, there's a huge Christian music festival, the Cornerstone Festival, that happens in July. And this year was their last year. You know, so 25 years of introducing this region to new Christian bands, and it's over because people have just lost interest. They stopped coming out. And to a certain extent, there's been, back in the, you know, 90s, early 90s, mid-90s, there was a very solid wall between secular music and Christian music. And there were clear Christian bands that were on Christian record labels and sold in Christian bookstores. And then there was everyone else. There was the world's music, which was sold in the world's record stores. And over the last 15 years, that wall has broken down. And you have, you know, more and more new artists reject labels. They don't want to be, we don't want to be a Christian band. You know, we just want to be a band, but our faith will come out in our music. You know, and it's kind of started with Jars of Clay and then, you know, Switchfoot and guys like that, where they rejected the notion of starting in the Christian subculture. And so we have a generation of Christian kids that don't even think that way anymore. They just listen to music. And we even have, you know, we have Christian magazines like Relevant that review music and don't even necessarily tell you if it's a Christian band or not a Christian band. And I find myself in my, you know, older thinking of, hey, what are they Christians? I can't tell from this, you know, interview. it's interesting, you know, and there's positives in that, but it's also tricky as a parent to figure out what am I okay with my kids listening to,
right,
if it doesn't come with nice labels.
Well, I think what you're seeing is things are getting more complicated. There was a season in American Christianity where it was all about revolution. We're going to invade our culture and take it over and transform,
right,
everything.
And we almost did. We were that close. It was the Passion of the Christ was almost put it over the top.
And then there was a season where it wasn't about revolution. It was about retreat. We're going to retreat into our enclaves. We're going to have our own Christian communities, our own Christian stores, our own Christian music, our own Christian radio, our own Christian television, where you can be safe.
Right.
And now that's breaking down. And so if you don't have the revolution or the retreat model, what is the new model?
Does it need to start with an R?
Yes, it has to start with an R.
Runaway! Oh, that's retreat. Rats.
Re-engage.
It's the rats model.
Re-engage. Yeah, I mean, I really think that, you know, I am constantly thinking about we need to be, you know, not of the world, but we do need to be in it. And we need to live differently,
right,
and not, you know, necessarily separate and apart.
The thing that's hard about it, I think you're absolutely right, Christian, is that model requires a different motivation than fear. Revolution can be driven by fear. We have to take over, otherwise, right, the bad guys are going to win. Retreat is definitely motivated by fear.
Run away,
we got to say. But to engage, you can't be afraid. And
right,
what typically has driven evangelical Christianity in America, except for some wonderful exceptions, is fear. So the question is for this younger generation, what are Christian leaders trying to make them afraid of? And the problem is they're really not afraid of much. I mean, I think it's a good,
yeah,
thing ultimately, but that the old model, the old way of thinking required some level of fear.
Right.
The way you make a Christian subculture work with retail is you make them afraid of secular retail. These products are going to be bad for you and your family. We've got all the products that,
right,
are safe for you and your,
right,
family. It's fear-based.
Well, that's how Christian radio works.
That's right.
It's all, you know, Christian radio works. It's safe for little ears, safe for your kids in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, what gets moms to listen to Christian radio. It seems like because all the walls are breaking down in distribution and there's no longer, you know, really secular distribution and Christian distribution, there's just YouTube, you know, and there's just iTunes. What is a little tricky is that, you know, I've got friends that worked at Amazon who said, you know, there's a pretty strong anti-Christian bias in the culture of Amazon simply because of where it is geographically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the Northwest, and the Northwest is a highly unchurched place. So they're not really excited about selling Christian stuff. They just do it, you know, and we're seeing that even more so with new online destinations like Hulu and Netflix, where there's a stronger bias against putting Christian stuff up because they don't want to be associated. So for many people, Christianity is a brand that they don't want to be close to. And it's actually could get harder for Christian creatives and Christian artists to get their stuff out there as this bias. You know, if people associate Christianity with Westboro Baptist Church,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, people that hate gay people, they will rise up above just the desire to make money to say, as a matter of principle, I do not want to associate my brand.
Right.
With,
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. There's been survey after survey after survey that's shown that the general population generally views Christianity as a Republican, conservative, anti-gay.
And backwards.
And if you're running a business that needs to appeal to the entire population, you don't,
right,
want to isolate it by saying, well,
right,
we're really in favor of Christianity if the general population views it as bigoted and right-wing and partisan.
I got to tell you, I mean, I have trouble a lot of times telling people my name is Christian.
You could change it to Buddhist.
You know, because I really do feel like it's very difficult. I don't want to be associated with that ideal either. You know, I want to be associated with, you know, the person of Jesus Christ, which a lot of times today I don't think lines,
mm-hmm,
up with,
right,
you know, what
it's
Christianity
a tricky
is
world we live
as.
In, and it's not likely to get less tricky in the next 10 or 20 years.
Agreed.
Likely to get more tricky. Okay, so the Christian world, at least the world of Christian retail, is shrinking, and we just have to deal with it. I wanted to just touch on what happened in Colorado last week and the shootings, just because there's a, I mean, you can't ignore it, you know, when something happens that's that big. And so obviously, you know, our prayers are with all those people, and it's really a horrid thing. One pastor said, made a comment after the shooting, actually on Sunday, which was just as we're recording this yesterday, that he just wonders what kind of people we are becoming, you know, when we're capable of that. And something like that seems to happen, you know, like every other month, every 3 or 4 months, and starting to more so, you know, internationally with what happened in, was it Norway?
Mm-hmm.
It's scary stuff. And the way this guy went about it, you know, wearing full body armor and a gas mask, and he kind of looked like he was in a video game, you know, and I'm wondering how much he thought. I mean, he looked like the Master Sergeant from Halo, the way he was decked out. You know, and do you really need body armor when you're the only one in the room with a gun? I mean, what was even I'm wondering if he was playing a game in his head.
Well, what you're seeing now is everyone's trying to point the finger. Is it the video games? Is it the violence?
I'm not saying it was the video games. But I'm just saying we seem to, when you start to lose bearing with an external morality, you know, isn't it just a game? To see, I mean, the kid on the island in Norway, wasn't that just, so let's see how many I can kill. How many, what was my score?
Yeah, this tragedy in Colorado, it's too early to diagnose exactly what happened here.
Right.
But, you know, my hunch is these are going to be found to be very mentally ill individuals, like the guy in Norway. Perhaps this
But how do we know? Shooter. How do we know?
We don't.
It is impossible because you know what? Someone that is a healthy, well-adjusted human being, even though they may not, they, you know, they're still, I believe, you know, wrecked with original sin, mm-hmm. is not going to do things like that. You know, you're just not. It's not a sane thing to do. So. It's not a sane thing to do.
Yeah. But if
here's a different way of, I've talked to a handful and one man in particular who's in the military, coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and the struggle that these soldiers are having readjusting to civilian life after having been in very violent situations, and one of the tragic things that's coming out now is more soldiers are dying through suicide than at the hands of the enemy,
right?
You know, my theology is that when one human being kills another human being, even when it's justifiable, even when it's necessary in such a time of war, there's just something intrinsically wrong about that.
Something happens.
We are not designed to do that. Now, and helping these men and women readjust to life outside of a war situation is an incredibly high responsibility that we have because we ask them to do this. We need to help them readjust. But it does trigger something weird in the human psyche. And I think as a culture, when we are constantly watching images of humans killing other humans, even in fictional storytelling, in movies and video games, stuff like that, it does do something to us.
It is desensitizing.
It desensitizes, but it also, I think, creates a level of abnormality in which it's not just desensitizing, it's... I think there's something spiritual about it, where we see the murder of other human beings, and it warps our perception of the value of human life. And once you've taken a population and helped them not really value human life anymore, then you're opened up to all kinds of tragedies and awful circumstances.
Right. Well, at the same time, we no longer have a universal... a universally held belief about the importance of human life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing we can agree on to say this is why human life is important, other than we think it probably should be, and we hope nobody disagrees because bad things happen when we do. But we just, and especially what's interesting is this kid, you know, came out of academia. I mean, he was a doctoral candidate, so his experience was in very high-end research and science. You know, which is an area that does say more than most areas of the humanities, there's nothing different than people and animals. We're just developed further along. Mm-hmm. We have a higher capacity. And that's, you know, that can't not have any impact on you.
Well, there are plenty of people in the sciences who aren't going to take automatic weapons and kill other people.
Who
hold to a very naturalistic worldview. I don't think that worldview automatically leads to...
No, it doesn't.
...murder.
But it doesn't automatically constrain it either.
Right. The story hasn't been told yet. We don't know what's behind this. We may never fully know. And whatever the answer is, it's not going to fully satisfy our desire for an explanation as to why this happened.
So do we need to get rid of guns or video games or atheism? Pick one. How about atheistic gun-wielding video games?
I believe we are going to have difficult, horrible things happen until Jesus returns.
Yes.
And I think
this is
no matter what we do to try to protect ourselves or to prevent it, this is a broken, fallen world, and it's stuff like this is going to continue to happen.
Yeah. Wouldn't you have a harder time killing, you know, shooting 70 people in 5 minutes without an assault rifle?
Without and like 6,000 rounds of ammunition? Yeah. I might have a harder time
Holy
doing that.
Holy mackerel. It does
become
harder. I don't
know why he even would think he would need that much ammunition. It's just not logically sane.
It becomes a little harder to you know, be the gun collector that says, but I just want to have the ability to own a really nice assault rifle for my collection and look at what other people are doing with the same
applaud a couple of people in the media. Mike Huckabee is one of them, who I don't know if you've heard his his sort of show where basically he says, I'm not going to say this guy's name, and I'm not even going to talk about him. We're going to talk about, you know, these victims and their families. And one thing I've really enjoyed is listening to the stories of heroics and what people did for other people during that time of tragedy. It's an amazing testament to the goodness in people.
Right.
And that's been a blessing to listen to.
Okay. Moving on. Penn State.
Penn State. Great. Yeah. More uplifting human trauma and tragedy.
Hey, but you know what? The NCAA moved swiftly.
$60 million in fines, 4 years without being able to go to a bowl game. And this is what I'm wondering. There's a couple of things that I wanted to mention about this. So Joe Paterno, poor old Joe Paterno.
Jopa.
His statue's been removed. And today, and they painted the halo out of the mural on campus that where he has a halo.
He did not. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, there's a big mural, and he has a halo in it because he was considered such an upright guy. They painted out the halo. So his halo has fallen. His statue was removed yesterday from campus, and they the NCAA took away 100 of his wins, so
he's no longer the winningest coach
in college football. Now, you know, he's culpable. He's culpable for what happened. Does that really mean you should have football games taken away from your record?
Here's the thing. They're sending a message. You know, and in the past, the NCAA has not been this swift at all. In fact, they've been traditionally extremely slow at responding to stuff like this, and their punishments not being that impactful.
Yeah.
And so I think it is sending a major, major message.
I guess.
You know, and in a lot of ways, I mean, yes, you can argue both sides. It's debatable. Does it need to be that bad? But I think, frankly, the fact that they're taking it this seriously and what they are doing is sending a message to all other programs, not just the football programs. I think it really does send a message that, you know, this is a thing that needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah. I think what's interesting for me to think about is to draw the comparison between what happened over the last 20 years in the Catholic Church and what happened at Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's so many people who have said, well, obviously the Catholic Church is evil if this stuff can be covered up, you know, and if people don't turn people in that they know. And I think there's something interesting when you look at the psychology. What happens in your head when you find out someone you really, really know well and care about is doing something terrible?
Yeah.
You know, what happens?
Breaks my heart.
It breaks your heart, but you just, it's...
We've had to report on this a number of times through Leadership Journal, or I've found out about stories at significant churches where a leader was engaged in something that some of the people around him were aware of but didn't do anything about it until years later it all comes out and the whole ministry comes crashing down.
Right.
And when you ask those people, well, why didn't you do anything about it? And in these cases, there wasn't a child victim kind of – it wasn't a criminal act. But why didn't you do anything? And the response is usually, well, you know, God was still doing great things through this person and I didn't want to destroy the whole ministry. And therefore you turn a blind eye to the stuff. And we do this all the time. It may not be – criminal or even unethical, but there are leaders who are complete tyrants. in their churches, and people just go, well, yeah, I know he's really a jerk,
but
and
he's doing good.
No fruit of the Spirit.
And the good outweighs the bad.
Exactly. And that kind of stuff goes on and on and on because we are so enamored with effectiveness
right.
that we put it in favor of
And in these cases, because if I imagine if you went to Joe Paterno or if you were in the Catholic Church and you went to the Cardinal and said, hey, I just saw a stranger who came into one of our churches and did this terrible thing to this kid. Well, they'd say, well, let's get him. You know, let's call the cops. But it's like, but it was a friend of yours. I walked in on a good friend of mine doing something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with that? I don't know how to process it. You know, the victim, my friend, you know, and I think, I mean, you can see for one thing, it's not exclusive to the Catholic Church.
Right.
It happens when you find out information that you really don't want to be true. You really try to rationalize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to avoid ruining my good friend's life.
Well, we do that for ourselves too.
No.
We don't want to look at the darker sides of our own sinfulness, and we rationalize it, and we bury it, and we justify it. And when we went,
which is, you know, our sinful nature.
Right.
I think it has something to do with that.
Dealing with our
sinful
nature.
Well, I think part of this lesson is that sin is not just present in individuals. It's also present in our institutions. There can be institutionalized injustice. And I think Penn State was guilty of that, and now they're facing the consequences.
So part of it may be not just the preservation of my friend, but the preservation of my institution.
Exactly.
If I bring this out, you know, it could bring all of this down. Mm-hmm. It could, everything we're doing, all the good that we're doing, could the legacy, it could all just crumble because I blow a whistle.
And to go all the way further back, this goes to our earlier conversation, Phil. This is what happens when you put your identity and significance into a ministry or into an organization or into a structure rather than in Christ himself. When everything is built into your ministry, then you'll do anything to preserve it, including justify your own or other sinful actions.
Right.
And that leads to all kinds of problems.
So if my identity is Christ and I know something that I need to bring to the forefront, but it will bring down my church, my parents, my best friend, I can do that.
Yeah.
You should do
because
that.
Ultimately it's not your church.
Right. Good point. Valuable. Okay, well, if anyone at Penn State or the Catholic Church is listening, it was Sky's idea. He's the one who said it. Here's something on a slightly smaller scale. Did you hear that Bob and Larry have a new owner?
I did.
You did hear that?
Yeah.
I hear it's DreamWorks.
Bob and Larry, of course, are owned by Big Idea. I believe the current company is called Big Idea Entertainment because every time it has changed hands, they've had to create a new company to clean off.
Hmm.
It's kind of odd. So my company was Big Idea Productions, and then there was just Big Idea Inc., and now there's Big Idea Entertainment, which is the third company to own Bob and Larry. But what's interesting is we've gotten some Facebook, as people have heard about the purchase. So anyway, Classic Media is the company that owns Big Idea, and Classic Media was just bought by DreamWorks. And so all these people are writing in to say, what does it mean? What does it mean for my favorite vegetables? And I wanted to run through just a couple of the comments because they're kind of interesting. So Jennifer commented and says, what does that mean for VeggieTales? Will they change it in any way if you make new ones? First of all, Jennifer, I don't make new ones. I haven't made a VeggieTales episode in 10 years, so it isn't me. I don't know if they'll change anything. Zilka says, wow, goodbye Christian values.
That's just funny.
Not necessarily true.
Civilization is ending because DreamWorks now owns Protestant produce.
Becky says, they're not going to wreck it, are they? Well, here's one thing that I think everybody is missing. It has been 10 years since Big Idea had Christian ownership. So if you've seen anything happen in the last 10 years that you felt was wrecking it, then there'll probably be more of that. but there probably won't be new wrecking of it. Because it's just the same. It's basically the same.
I think it's interesting how many people don't know that fact.
Yeah, apparently. Connie wrote me and said, will they allow you the freedom to keep saying the name of Jesus? I don't have any freedom to say anything with it.
Except what they tell you to say.
I get scripts.
You do record the voices.
I get scripts and I read them in characters, and then they pay me, and then I invest that money in what's in the Bible. That's pretty much how it works. So I don't see any change happening. What is interesting and is probably worth discussing is, you know, why would DreamWorks want to own Classic Media? Classic Media owns a gazillion old characters.
Like?
Casper the Friendly Ghost, Richie Rich, Wendy the Witch.
Rudolph
the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Lone Ranger.
Lassie, Underdog.
Little Engine That Could.
The Little Engine That Could, the Pokey Puppy. Little Puppy. John Ellenbogen, Eric Ellenbogen and John Engelman are the two partners that created Classic Media, and they've been buying what you would call distressed assets. So, for example, the Harvey catalog, which is Casper and Richie Rich and all that stuff, was in bankruptcy. They bought it out. Little Golden Books was in bankruptcy. They bought it out. Yes, and they collect all these things, and then they build them up, and then they try to sell them again. So what they've done is sell all this stuff to DreamWorks. Why would DreamWorks want it? Well, did anybody hear of any movies with chipmunks in them in the last 5 years that did much better than you would have thought they would have done? Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. They've now made 3 Chipmunks movies, not DreamWorks, a different studio. The point is, those were old, dead characters that you assume aren't worth anything, except they have brand awareness. They have broad brand awareness, which is extraordinarily expensive to create new broad brand awareness. So what's happened over the last few years is people are mining libraries looking for old brands to bring back. So they made an Underdog
movie. Because it's less expensive
than creating. It's much less expensive to bring back something people have already heard of. Disney is producing a $200 million Lone Ranger movie co-starring Johnny Depp as Tonto, which is actually a licensing deal with Classic Media, the owners of Bob and Larry. So DreamWorks, clearly, the same reason that Disney bought Marvel, it's for the characters. There's like 200 Marvel characters that they can now mine to make new movies. DreamWorks wants to own characters too. So, and this is probably the biggest collection of old classic characters in one place in the world, and DreamWorks now owns it. What is interesting is that really what they want is characters that they can mine for mainstream movies and mainstream TV shows. Well, that's not VeggieTales.
Right.
You know, VeggieTales has zero potential for mainstream movies or mainstream TV shows. So do they even want it? Don't know. So that's interesting to watch. Are they really interested
in
VeggieTales? What are they going to do with VeggieTales? Are they just going to leave it alone?
Will they sell it?
Will they? I don't know what they'll do. So it's, you know, the next 6 months will be kind of interesting to keep an eye on. The tomato and the cucumber.
Well, I think people, going back to the retail issue from earlier in this podcast, I think people would be amazed to know how many Christian companies are actually subsidiaries of non-Christian larger companies.
Oh, there are very few that aren't.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, 2 weeks ago it was announced that Rupert Murdoch's company, News Corp, is buying Thomas Nelson.
Right. They already own Zondervan.
Which
also owns the new international version of the Bible.
Yes. And Nelson owns the CEV and several other translations of the Bible, and was at one point the largest Bible publisher in the world. So Rupert Murdoch is now the largest Bible publisher in the world by far.
Wow.
In fact, Tyndale House opposed the sale on the grounds that it was creating a monopoly.
Yeah.
In Bible
sales. Well, they could change the name of News Corp to Good News Corp, except it's not behaved very good, has
it? No. So the people that bring you, you know, the Fox Network and
all those racy tabloids.
Yeah, and really racy tabloids in the UK now bring you the NIV and the CEV and who knows what else. It is a crazy world. None of the Christian music companies are Christian owned anymore. They all were sold.
Well, and this, I mentioned earlier that I did a little study trying to figure out which companies and how many companies have Christians called for the boycott of over the last 10 years, and it's just infinite, right?
Yeah, it's all of them.
Yeah, pretty much all of them. But the problem is, even when you think you are participating with a corporation that is quote unquote Christian, they're actually a subsidiary of some larger company.
Right.
There's no way
right.
to isolate these companies from one another and say, I'm only going to patronize those which
right.
are
we,
good Christian companies with good Christian values.
We did
values.
A deal at Big Idea. We did a deal with Hallmark to do VeggieTales keepsake Christmas ornaments.
Aww.
We got an angry letter, I may have been pre-email, angry letter from someone saying, I will never buy another VeggieTales product because you have yoked yourself with an unbeliever. you know, and I just want to go back. If you've listened to any Christian music in the last 15 years or bought a Bible, except for from Crossway or Tyndale House in the last 15 years, you've yoked yourself with an unbeliever. There are very few independent Christian publishers anymore. They're all part of larger mainstream publishing companies, and there are no major independent Christian music companies anymore, which is a bit sad and a bit concerning because the motivation does change, you know, and they always say, we want you to keep doing what you're doing. We just keep doing what you're doing, except that instead of, I mean, if you go to Tyndale House, because Tyndale is a Christian-owned, it's actually a nonprofit, same with, I think, Crossway is also a nonprofit publisher, their bottom line is, are we doing ministry? Mm-hmm. You know, now they have to stay profitable, they have to stay solvent so they can keep going, but the way they measure success is
different.
Ministry success. If you go to HarperCollins, which now owns Zondervan and Thomas Nelson, or Classic Media, which owns Big Idea, the way they compensate the people running those companies has nothing to do with ministry.
Right.
You know, the compensation packages are all sales goals, and that does affect the way you run a company. It can't not. And I think part of the decline in Christian music and possibly in Christian publishing is just the fact that from the top down, there's now no difference in management between secular companies. You know, the motives are the same, the strategies are the same, and a lot of what was special about those companies when their founders started them has been lost, unfortunately. That's enough. You have anything else to say about that?
Not really, no.
Okay. So
me either.
Okay, good. 2 weeks ago, we did a podcast on dreams, and we've got some really interesting responses, so I wanted to catch up on those a little bit. Okay, this was interesting. Nathan wrote and said, so what works for God do you pursue if you can't dream? I mean, God didn't come to you in a trance when you made What's in the Bible. Which is an interesting question, and part of that is still semantic. You know, if I say I can't dream, I mean, I think that definition of the word dream, because we were saying dream means a deep longing. If you can't long for things, well, you know, I long for God, I long for heaven, so that's separate. That I think the definition you were using is if you can't brainstorm, which is ridiculous. Of course I can brainstorm. I can, you know, brainstorm all day long, and I can come up with a zillion ideas, and I can put them up on the wall. I can get excited about them. But I think what we're talking about ultimately is where do you put your security and where do you invest your heart, your emotion, you know, your passion. Because anywhere you invest your heart other than God is a dangerous place to park your heart, because you're gonna get hurt. Whether it's, you know, in a marriage, in a family, in a ministry, in a company, anywhere you park your heart other than in your Creator is a dangerous parking place, and you're gonna pick up door dings. Because
how far are you gonna go with this analogy?
Seriously.
So, do you want to add anything?
No, I think we covered this in the last one. It's not a matter of do you pursue things for God or don't you. It's why, and it's the sequence, the priority. The danger is when we invest our identity and significance into these projects rather than into Christ.
And didn't we say there's a difference between a calling and a dream, or was that more of semantics? I mean, in a sense, you know.
How do you define calling?
Well, this is getting into actually what I'm writing about in my next book, to a degree.
Which is called what?
Spoiler.
Tomorrowland, which I am way behind on writing. I think what we have done is largely taken over the role of the Holy Spirit. It's the Holy Spirit who calls us. One of the great texts that I love to talk about in this is at the end of John's Gospel, John 21. After the resurrection, Jesus is on the beach with his disciples. He's making them breakfast, and that's the one scene where he calls Peter to feed my sheep and all that. And then at the end of the story, Jesus says to Peter, you know, the day is coming when someone will lead you where you don't want to go. And he's alluding to Peter's eventual martyrdom. And Peter receives this, and he may not have been too happy. And so he sees John down the way a little bit, and he points to him and says, well, what about him? What's his calling? And Jesus just says, hey, that's none of your business. If I want him to remain to the end, that's for me to decide. You follow me. And I think what Jesus is communicating there is it's his job to call his people to the works he has for them. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't like that very much. especially those of us in ministry. So we want to step in and take over that responsibility for ourselves and tell everyone what they should be doing with their lives.
Right.
You know, okay, you can be an accountant or you can work on an assembly line or you can be an artist, but if you really want to matter, then you should do, you know, fill in the blank. And we get the things all out of order. What we should be doing as ministers is calling people to a deep communion with Christ and modeling for them how that works and how to do it. And then in their communion with Christ, they receive a call, something that he is calling them to do, gifts he has given them, whatever it might be. And then we affirm that. We come alongside, affirm that, and then help them along the way in obeying that call.
Right, right.
But if you don't have a theology of calling, a theology of vocation, then you're going to step into that vacuum as a minister and take over the role of the Holy Spirit and call people to the work you think matters most. And then what ends up happening is you get responses similar to the ones we've been reading, which is everyone has this hierarchy of what they think is really important in the world,
right,
and all the work that's not important. And if I just engage in more of the work that's important, then I'm important. Then I
right,
matter.
Right.
And that's really what's fueled a lot of evangelicalism for about 50 years.
One of the things that got me off track at Big Idea is in Bible college, I heard a sermon on the notion of knowing God's will. And the solution offered, and it was from a preacher who also actually had a master's or a doctorate in mathematics, which may have been a bad sign right from the beginning. But he said, if you don't know what God wants you to do, do the test of spiritual expediency. Which approach, which option has the most potential for impact?
Mm-hmm.
That is God's will. You know, and that mathematically, that makes perfect sense. Logically, it makes perfect sense. Biblically, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Right.
You know, God may be calling you to do something extraordinarily small in scope,
mm-hmm,
or huge in scope, or both, or neither.
1 Thessalonians 4:11, I've yet to ever hear a sermon on this. Paul says to the Thessalonians, he says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and work with your hands. Why do we never hear that message in our churches?
Because it doesn't get anything done.
Well, he was just talking to that specific group
yeah,
of people.
Yeah, it's cultural.
Right.
But when they were troublemakers.
But then we'll take passages about, you know, go impact the world, and it's, well, that applies to all of us.
Right.
And how do you do that? You know, so I think what we've lost, and frankly, the irony here is during the Protestant Reformation, this theology of vocation really came to the forefront. Because in the Roman Catholic system at the time, the clergy were seen as the only ones who had a vocation. Vocation came from the Latin vocare, meaning to call. The only people legitimately called were the clergy. And all the laity were meaningless. They were riffraff.
Were uncalled.
Uncalled, right. Well, the Reformation happens, and these Protestant leaders like Luther and Calvin come along and say, no, 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 everyone has a vocation. Everyone is called. And if you're a butcher, that is a divine vocation because you are doing something that is honorable and good for the whole community, and God is blessed and honored when you do that work as unto the Lord.
Hmm.
And so the Protestant work ethic came along because suddenly it mattered if I was a farmer or a butcher or a teacher or whatever it is I was called to do. And you see Western civilization really begin to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
That lasted up until about the late 1800s. And this might bother some people, but I think one of the reasons we've lost that theology of vocation within Protestantism is because of the modern missionary movement. And I'm a big fan of the modern missionary movement. I'm ordained in the Christian Missionary Alliance. But when the modern missionary movement happened in the mid-late 19th century, for the first time, people started coming to churches and asking you to give your money to projects that you would never see the fruit of. Because up until that point, if you gave money to the church, it stayed in your local community. It helped the poor.
Right.
It built your church. It paid for your clergy. But the modern missionary movement came along and said, no, we want to take your money and we want to go overseas and do something that you will never see the fruit of. Well, how do you get people to part with their money for something that they're never going to see? Is you slowly begin to concoct and build a theology that said mission work matters more than everything else.
Right.
And that's why you should give your money to it. And they begin to weave a theology that gets people to part with their money. And you do that for 150 years, and that theology has so taken over the church that it has absolutely stamped out the theology of vocation that says all callings are equally valid, and the issue is discerning what is God calling you to. Now what we've said is, no, missionary is the most valid calling. Pastor is just under that.
Right.
And then everything else is down the list. Except when you behave like a pastor or a missionary, or you can fund them through your work.
What I grew up with, I think, growing up in Bible missionary conferences, is the best thing you could ever do is world missions, preferably somewhere with cannibals. You know, somewhere
the danger,
the better. Secondarily is the pastorate,
mm-hmm.
And then,
which also can have cannibals.
The third option you have is to just work hard, make money to give to option one or option two.
Exactly. Right.
And that was really it.
That was it.
Okay, so I guess I'll be a banker so I can fund missions, but I have no role in it other than funding.
And two things happen as a result. Number one, you take the vast majority of Christians who are not clergy, not pastors or missionaries, and you devalue what they do for their lives. And then the second thing is you begin to attract people into ministry for the wrong reason. Not because they may be genuinely called or gifted, but because they're looking for significance.
Right.
And then you wonder why 1,500 pastors burn out a month in the United States.
That's a great point.
Here's a question someone has for you, Sky.
Ooh.
It says, I think it was Sky that said something along the lines of his calling to be to unveil the body of Christ being completely content in Christ alone.
Not exactly.
I think that may have been somewhere between the two of us merging it together. I take a small issue with that because it seems to me that the work for God is inherently interwoven, interwevened on into our relationship with God. While I agree that Christ must be our everything, our true love in every way, isn't our work for God inherent to our relationship with God, so much so that if we rest in Him but do nothing to share the gospel, we are in defiance of God?
Okay. Well, you know, this dichotomy is often what comes up is, well, if I just focus on my relationship with God, then the mission never gets done.
And I won't do anything.
I won't do anything. And I think that's, at least in my experience, it's the complete opposite. The more I am experiencing communion with Christ, the more motivated I am to share the goodness of that treasure with others.
Right.
But if I'm not experiencing communion with Christ, then I might be perpetuating mission. Someone made the great comment that, you know, when you go and buy a car, and a few days later, you have buyer's remorse. Like, oh, should I really have bought that car? Was it too much money? You feel a whole lot better if you can convince your friend to go buy the same car. Because then it's reaffirming the decision you made in the first place. And I think a lot of the times we try to fuel evangelism by the same model, which is, well, yeah, I've made a decision to be a Christian, and it really hasn't made any substantive impact on my life. I don't know Christ in any meaningful, experiential way, but it's going to make me feel better if everyone around me also makes this decision. Versus somebody who's informing others about Christ out of genuine knowledge and experience of communion with Him. That's a whole different way of evangelizing. Right. So I think mission happens best when people are actually in rich, deep communion with Christ. And the best thing you can do for evangelism, there's been studies that have shown this at Willow Creek and others, that it's those Christians who have the most mature relationship with Christ who are the most effective at evangelism, not just those who are the most on fire because they're new believers. Mm. So depth drives mission.
Okay.
Not the other way around.
So let's encourage depth. Go deep, everyone. What's your tip for the week for how to go deeper this week?
Practice silence.
And that's a great tip.
Let's all do it together on the podcast for the next 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Hey, I can't start till you're silent. Hey.
It's going to be really tough for me.
Hey, stop it. You're okay, we're out of time. So practice some silence this week, guys.
Why don't you start with your ukulele, Phil?
Nothing provokes.
Are you
silence
becoming
like
a ukulele hater?
Oh, I think we should call it the hate ukulele.
Oh, listen to this. Listen to this.
You're gonna read us the ukulele hate mail?
Yes. P.S. He loves the show. He likes the show. About the ukulele, I love it, but standardize your lyrics. Right now, it sounds unprofessional. Not saying to idolize your idea, but if you do something good, you should do it right.
Ooh.
And I say. Have you ever heard someone play the ukulele while randomly making up a song to summarize a Christian podcast better than I have?
No, absolutely.
So how would you know what it sounds like when it's done professionally? How you don't know unprofessional football until you've seen professional football. This may be the most professional making up a song with a ukulele to summarize a Christian podcast.
I don't know. Have you
ever
seen, well, maybe summarizing a Christian podcast, but have you ever seen Wayne Brady make up stuff?
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying
word.
This is professional making up songs. I'm saying this is professional making up songs with a ukulele
to summarize
a Christian
you
podcast.
You can qualify anything enough to make yourself the expert at it.
Yes. Thank you. My point exactly.
Which he just did.
Hey, we've been talking about lots of things, and that makes it kind of hard to sing, because I don't know what to summarize with my song, ba-doo-ba-doo. So I guess I'll just have to wrap it up today. and sing my little unprofessional song anyway, because we gotta say goodbye and you can all go along to your lives and practice some silence. Goodbye.